Efforts have begun in DeWitt to address ethnically charged school incidents that followed last month's presidential election. Within a few days, school officials referred to at least three incidents involving harassment of and comments toward Hispanic students back on Wednesday, November 9th. School administrators have announced several actions, including disciplinary measures and focus groups involving ethnic toleration and respect. Meanwhile, the Lansing State Journal said the conversation about the incidents at a public gathering last week at DeWitt High School became heated. So how does a school and community constructively respond to such incidents? We have two guests today to help us sort through that. Dr. Dorinda Carter-Andrews is an expert on the role of race in educational outcomes. She's worked with school districts on these issues and is an associate professor in Michigan State's Department of Teacher Education. Welcome back to WKAR.
Thank you, Mark.
And Dr. Tara VanZant Chambers studies academic achievement and school engagement with a focus on minority students. She's an associate professor of K-12 Education Administration. Welcome.
Thank you.
Dorinda Carter-Andrews, I understand that several people in DeWitt have reached out to you following these incidents. Have you become involved with the follow-up to these at DeWitt?
Not as of late, Mark. I have been contacted by the superintendent and also by a teacher, but it's kind of been a back and forth as of yet, and so I haven't been able to actually have a conversation with the superintendent.
Would you like to get involved?
Absolutely. I have a history with the district and would love to kind of rekindle that relationship and help them work through these issues.
I mean, in one incident, apparently a group of male, presumably white students, locked arms and prevented some number of other students from passing. We're led to believe at least one Hispanic girl was unable to get to her locker. In another, students, and I'm quoting here, commented about minority students, unquote. I want to ask you both, these were not the only school incidents like this to happen in the days following the election. Generally, Tara, what did you make of this uptick?
Sure. Well, you know, I think several things. First, you know, I think this reflects the fact that it's difficult to separate politics and current events from what happens in schools. Kids know about these things, they're affected by them, and they talk about what's happening in the world. And so teachers and other school leaders need to be prepared to have these conversations, regardless of what their personal viewpoints might be. I also hear people say that folks feel emboldened to say or to act in particular ways. I think that's part of it. And the difficult part of what's happening right now, at least for school personnel, is that the things that are being said about many minoritized groups in the United States run in counter or direct into the things that we teach children in school about respect for others. And I think that's a difficult thing for people to navigate. So is there an uptick? Maybe. I'm in contact with school folks every day. And on any given day, they're working through a lot of different challenging or important issues. And sometimes there's a window with what gets taken up right now. And for good reason, our focus is on this kind of issue.
In various statements, DeWitt school administrators have said the following here. The students involved have been disciplined according to our code of conduct for ethnic harassment. Teachers spent several days in their classrooms covering tolerance and respect, and that those lessons would continue, and that longer-term focus groups would be created to address these issues, quote, on a larger scale. Dorinda, all of these measures sound appropriate. What do you make of them?
Well, I think you're right. They sound appropriate, but I think we first have to ask, how are you framing the issue? And one thing to think about, Mark, is are these teachers confident in actually facilitating these types of dialogues with young people? Are they skilled to do that? Do they have the necessary tools in their own kind of teacher toolkit to do that? And framing is really important. So even using the language of how do we teach tolerance can send a certain type of message to young people and family. So what are you saying? Do I have to be tolerated? As opposed to how do we help young people understand how to respect and affirm diverse people, individuals, and families. So I think for one, one ways in which schools can think about this is really focus on how they frame the dialogue and the issues, because who wants to be tolerated in a learning space when they can have an opportunity to actually be affirmed and celebrated? And then secondly, are teachers actually adequately skilled to engage discussions about inequity, difference, privilege, power? Probably all of the teachers in DeWitt are not. And so a very first next step is to help those teachers acquire that training.
To what extent do we take into consideration the ages of the kids involved? These are seventh and eighth graders. There are a lot of really great, commendable young kids of that age, but it's also an age where there can be an awful lot of mischief. You hear some people say, "Hey, we need to understand. We need to move on and grapple with this constructively." It should be less about discipline, I think, than it should be about moving forward. How relevant are the ages of the kids in this?
You know, I think that this is a critically important issue. Even young children, though, can be engaged in appropriate conversations about respect for one another. I have a son who's in kindergarten, and my partner and I talk with him all the time about what's happening in the world. And those are hard conversations for us to have. We both have PhDs. It doesn't make it easier. But I'm encouraged to see that these conversations get easier with practice. And as kids get older, you can have more informed conversations. You're able to talk more specifically about these issues and bring other more complex issues into the conversation. So I'm encouraged that we can do this, and kids are going to be right there with us to have these conversations.
You know, bullying, addressing bullying has been a part of, you know, the school administrative landscape for quite a few years here now. Is there anything from the bullying conversation that can be used in these circumstances, Dorinda? What do you think?
I mean, I think that's a great question. You know, bullying regulations are not something that I'm up to date on, but I do think that we have to help children of all ages understand what's bullying, what's actual, you know, more specific forms of discrimination, racism, sexism, homophobia, and that bullying these things can be leveled, right? So you can verbally harass, but when does that turn into behavior, whether it's physical or verbal, that can have longer term consequences? And again, around the language we use, how do we name things for what they are? I think sometimes in schools, we will use language that's more comfortable for us. Kids understand what discrimination is and how people discriminate based on race, sexuality, gender, etc. And so talking to them about bullying is a start, but then naming things for what they are, because they see these things happening in the media, the larger society, and we don't call them bullying. We call them what they are, and young people need to have the language to actually nuance these things in their own lives.
Dr. Dorinda Carter-Andrews is an expert on the role of race in educational outcomes. She's on the faculty here at Michigan State University. Also, Dr. Tara Van Zandt Chambers studies academic achievement and school engagement with a focus on minority students. We're talking about efforts in the DeWitt School District to follow up on ethnically charged school incidents that followed last month's presidential election. The school seems to be taking the lead on this thing. Is it the school's responsibility to lead?
You know, I think the school has one role in leading, but I think parents and guardians have another role in leading. These conversations can't only take place in a school building. Kids are learning in all of their social spaces. And so to what degree are parents talking about issues of bias and discrimination and stereotypes at the dinner table, at the breakfast table? I think sometimes we feel like kids aren't ready to have these conversations. But there's a lot of research that shows they're already having them on the playground, mm-hmm. as early as preschool, as early as kindergarten. Kids are concerned with fairness and justice. And so it may be us adults who lack the confidence and courage to actually engage the discourse. So schools definitely should lead, but families need to be a part as well.
Well, it's interesting, though, you talk about the challenge of facilitating this conversation responsibly on the part of the faculty. Families have to navigate this conversation responsibly as well. It sounds very challenging.
Yeah.
And you alluded, Tara, to the fact that it happens in your family.
Yeah.
Yeah. To what extent should the larger community, I mean, we're talking about the school district and we're talking about families here. That's an awful lot of people. Who else needs to be a part of this conversation, would you say?
Yeah, that's a great question, actually. And, you know, I personally believe that there's a lot of power in the community. In many ways, how a community responds to a particular incident when they happen, or in some cases, how a community doesn't respond, also says a lot about the culture of a community. Fortunately, we have a lot of examples in the nation right now of communities that have come together to counter hate crimes, and I think that that says a lot about what communities value. So there's a lot of power in the community response.
Do you ever think that the more, as a society, that we condemn harassment or racism, that the more some segments of society might be inclined to commit those very acts? It's highly irrational, but I wonder if that isn't, I sometimes wonder, this is very subjective thought of mine, I sometimes wonder if that isn't what's happening here.
You know, one thing I would say, Mark, is that these acts aren't new. We know as a nation historically these acts of violence against marginalized groups, marginalized bodies have happened. So I think we live, you know, in a time where we have more quick accessibility to these acts now through social media, through our smartphones, etc. But we have to remember as a nation that this is nothing new. And so we've been trying to condemn these acts historically and in a contemporary way while they simultaneously happen. So I think the fight for justice is just continual. And the more that the media is able to kind of illuminate them, we just see them surface more.
Anything to add to that,
Tara?
Yeah,
no, I think Dr. Carter-Andrews makes a great point. I would also say that, you know, in most of these situations, we're not dealing with evil people. It's certainly the case when we're talking about kids. I think instead, we're seeing a response that people don't feel heard or they feel ignored or they don't know how to make sense of the events that are happening and they respond inappropriately. So just to dismiss these acts out of hand as racist, although they may be, it misses an opportunity for us to have a conversation. But it's also true that these responses often are inappropriate and they may also be racist or xenophobic or whatever. And to me, it highlights the need for courses, for professional development, for student assemblies, all kinds of opportunities to talk about teaching and leading for diversity, for equity, for social justice. These are not just throwaway courses. You know, what we're seeing in the world today is clear proof that we, more proof than we could ever imagine that, you know, like we need these kinds of conversations to happen.
Dorinda Carter-Andrews, you were a featured speaker at a local TED Talk a few years ago at which you said, quote, "Schools never have, nor do they currently, prepare adults and young people to learn how to respect each other across cultural differences," unquote. And you suggested it's important to understand how power works. You alluded to power in an earlier answer. How power works if we want to eliminate educational achievement gaps. Can you identify something about how power works that it's important for people to know?
Absolutely. So if we think about issues of power in schooling, we can think about the curriculum as one explicit example. What gets taught, whose history gets taught, and through what lens, what narrative? That's about issues of power and who has control over writing the textbooks, whose voices get illuminated. That's one example. If we think about teacher hiring and how that happens, right? And where we see majority students of color in schools, but the teaching faculty is predominantly white. That is not just happenstance. We know there are gatekeeping mechanisms like the teacher certification test that make it hard for students with certain cultural backgrounds to perhaps pass those tests the first time, not because they're inadequate, but the tests themselves have cultural nuances that test takers might not be familiar with. Those are just two concrete examples. One around curriculum, what kids have access to learn and through whose narrative, and then also around teacher hiring and retention that I can use to give examples for issues of power and how they play out in school.
I want to thank both of my guests, Dr. Dorinda Carter-Andrews, an expert on the role of race in educational outcomes, Dr. Tara Van Zandt, Grant Chambers studies academic achievement and school engagement with a focus on minority students. Both are on the faculty at Michigan State's College of Education. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you so much.